broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Investor Exchange. My name's Louis van Copenhagen, joined in the studio by Brett Dickinson.
Morning.
And Joel Hewish.
Good morning.
Good morning, boys.
Hey.
Has it been a fun week for everyone?
It's been all right.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
Can't complain.
Yeah.
Cold.
Well, that's nice that you can't complain. Coming into end of financial year, I've got plenty to complain about.
Yeah.
There's
princess.
Thanks. We are just about done. In fact, by the time this episode airs, it is probably going to be over.
Yeah, true.
So,
almost, oh no, it'll probably air today.
Over. Yeah, almost over.
People right. have a few days, so any last minute tips might still come in handy.
Yeah.
Oh, last minute tips.
Collingwood win on Saturday.
Yeah. That'll still be the day before the end of the financial year, so that works.
Nick Nat to have a screamer of a comeback for West Coast.
Looking likely.
Very good.
Yeah, you can play
looking
that
good. Looking good.
Mm. Yes, very good. So it's been a little while since there's been anything government-related to talk about.
Well, which is a surprise, because there's been a lot.
It's actually been quite nice not to talk about governments and elections for a little while. Mm-hmm. But, Brett, you're going to bring it back.
Yeah, I'm going to turn that around. And it's mainly around infrastructure. Reason being, an episode, I guess it was around 3 weeks ago, we spoke about the Victorian budget that was released. So it's budget season, if you like, for all of the states. So more and more of the states have released their budgets for the next financial year. And the overwhelming, I guess, theme through all of them is that there's a drop in revenue because of the stamp duty drops, which we discussed was the case for Victoria. So obviously with dwelling prices having fallen and transaction volumes, they're not collecting as much revenue. So they're looking at where else that could come from. But what the thing I've noticed is that's on the revenue side. On the spending side, it looks like the majority of states are going to all be going into debt in the near term, purely to fund infrastructure. And I see this as a pretty good thing, especially, you know, the cost of debt for all the states is quite low, and the infrastructure investments is going to create a lot of jobs that are probably coming off the construction industry somewhat.
Yep.
And probably a lead on too. If you look at it, when we had the mining boom and there was lots of jobs there and that died down, then we had the construction boom and that's sort of dying off. So now, to some degree, we're going to have an infrastructure boom based on the level of borrowings and the slated projects that are around.
Yeah.
So to give an example as to the types of dollars we're talking about, and I'm going to mainly focus on the three eastern states. They're the biggest ones with the biggest budgets. But all states, including Western Australia and South Australia in their budgets, have got a focus on infrastructure as well. Mm. But of all of them, the debt that they're going to take on, so the five mainland states' budgets have revealed that they will end up tripling their debt to $170 billion over the next 4 years.
Okay.
All around infrastructure splurges.
Righto. Mm-hmm.
So a lot of borrowing. So New South Wales, they've revealed that their net debt is going to balloon to $38.5 billion over the next 4 years, which is currently not even in a debt position. They're actually in a surplus position of $8.8 billion currently. So that's a significant change.
Yep.
South Australia, so one of the smaller states too, they're going to more than double their debt to $13 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Victoria, current net debt is already 38 and likely to double that to close to $80 billion over the next 4 years.
Yep.
Queensland debt levels are around $1.7 billion at the moment, but going to climb to $8 billion over 2019 and 20, and projected to reach $19.5 billion by 2022-23.
Okay.
Geez, there's some big explosions in debt sizes.
And these are the state budgets. So remember, a lot of the time, the infrastructure that we're talking about is quite often funded by federal government too.
Yeah.
So there was also in the federal government budget that was released earlier in this year, there was quite a lot of infrastructure spending there as well.
Mm.
So some good signs, I believe, that there's going to be a lot of jobs around, a lot of areas of the country that are going to have new infrastructure, therefore creating better living environments wherever that infrastructure is, and property opportunities.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
Okay, okay. What's your take on the economics of governments borrowing money to spend it?
Well, one person that I'd like to quote here, and I'm going to use a corny quote here, low wants high. So if you don't know what I mean by that, which I doubt you do, the Reserve Bank governor is Philip Lowe, okay? And he has urged governments to spend even more. So he wants high borrowing at the moment. And part of what his reasoning is, he says, right as of today, the Australian government can borrow at the cheapest rate since we became a federation. With the 10-year government bond rate at 1.35%, the government can borrow for almost 30 years at less than 2%.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing.
He's followed that up to say that there's got to be some projects out there that have got risk-adjusted returns at 1.5% to 2%.
Yeah.
So based on that, he's saying now would be the time to borrow and do them. Now, if I was a private business, I'd be borrowing as much as I can at those rates.
Yeah, if you're borrowing at a rate that's less than inflation,
mm.
and as long as you're putting that money into projects that will deliver benefits over time that will be worth more than that, well,
yeah.
I think it's worthwhile.
Absolutely. And the jobs it'll deliver in the process.
Yep.
The part that really irritates me about government spending is more when it's around about social welfare programs and things that are less productive. Things that are, you know, spending on
recurring spending that doesn't come back.
Correct. Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily generate an outcome.
Yep.
Gifts, handouts, these types of, you know.
Mm. Spending versus investing.
Correct.
To some degree.
Correct.
Is no, how you put it
right.
in.
Yeah, spending versus investing. That's right. Going into debt. To spend instead of going into debt to invest, is a bit frustrating.
Mm. Yep, can be. We won't get into that debate now because there's all kinds of different spendings governments can do, but there is definitely a lot of economists, as well as the Reserve Bank governor, who are trying to overcome this common perception that debt is bad and that governments should be measured according to their ability to deliver on a surplus or not.
Mm.
There's a lot of frustration around, and it's...
Well, it creates short-term thinking, doesn't it?
It creates short-term thinking, and governments need to be a bit contrarian to what the economy is doing. Because if the economy is contracting, which it is at risk of doing at the moment and in the short to medium term, governments have the ability to invest in projects like infrastructure, which create jobs, which heads off the risk of a recession. Mm. So the government is the one who has the ability to borrow the money and employ more people and put that money to work through that economic downturn and stabilize the economy. And then when the economy itself is doing well and private businesses are doing well, that's when the government should be cutting back and delivering a surplus in those times.
Yeah. And when you look at all of this infrastructure spending, I see there's the short-term benefit and the long-term benefit. So the short-term benefit, as you alluded to, jobs, employment, and you know potentially a boost for the economy by keeping money turning over. The long-term benefit is once the infrastructure's in place, the increased productivity that there is for the people that are getting the benefit of that.
Yeah, that's
true.
And
also with population growth, the more we can accept that population and have them, you know, working and commuting appropriately.
Yeah. So what are some of the things that are happening?
Well, look, I haven't got that on a state-by-state basis, but I did have a look at where the federal government was going to spend a lot of their funding on infrastructure. So, and the list is significant. So if I just look at what they said for nationals, so there's an urban congestion fund. I don't have dollar figures attached to each of these, but this is just the major projects that the federal government slated on their last budget. So there's an urban congestion fund, some funding towards roads of strategic importance, the Princess Highway that goes through New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia, and some local and state government road safety packages. So that's a nationwide scenario.
Yep.
In New South Wales, the federal government are going to throw money towards the Pacific Motorway extension to Raymond Terrace, the M12 motorway and Newell Highway upgrade, a third crossing of the Hawkesbury River, and Western Sydney's North-South Rail Link. Okay, so that's federal government only. So I haven't got the state government spending, but there's projects that they're either co-contributing to or that are separate to that again.
Mm.
Here in Victoria, federal government are going to contribute money towards Geelong's fast rail. They're going to help with suburban road upgrades in the southeastern and northern areas. The South Geelong to Warren Ponds rail upgrade, which will obviously tie in with the Geelong fast rail. A duplication of the Western Highway between Ballarat and Stawell. Sealing of the Dandenong ranges and surrounds, where the roads probably aren't so good at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And the Golden Valley Highway, the Shepparton Bypass stage, so they're going to do that. Queensland, the Gateway Motorway between Brackenridge and Pine River. Pacific Motorway upgrade from Daisy Hill to Logan. The Warrego Highway, a Cairns Ring Road, and the Gladstone Port Access Road extension. So along the eastern seaboard, that's, you know, the federal government have committed. The infrastructure projects that the state governments are doing are separate to that. And, you know, if you look at the balance of funding that the state governments are doing, you know, if they're all going to be contributing close to $170 billion over the next 3 to 4 years, it's got to be a lot of jobs out there. That money is going to be going, you know, into the hands of a lot of employees and employers.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you think of the kinds of jobs that will be creating. There'll be some high skilled jobs, engineering and architecture, but there'll also be low skilled jobs as well.
Yep, they need the labourers to do the work.
And someone's got to hold that stop sign.
Yep.
And turn it around.
Yep.
And they get paid pretty well too.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, look, anyone wanting to say, well, how does this play into, you know, my property plans? Well, as we've sort of discussed in the past, if you understand where the infrastructure is heading and what it's likely to do over the long term, who's going to be the beneficiary of that with new train stations, faster road access, whatever it might be, typically when a new area starts to really take off in terms of capital growth, it's because the lifestyle assets around there are better.
Mm-hmm.
And that the transport in and out of there becomes more convenient.
Mm.
So that would be something to have a look at. So there's too many, obviously, infrastructure projects to list, but if you're someone that's thinking of investing and you'd like to get an impact of where this is, have a look at the area you're thinking of investing and see what infrastructure is going to come through there.
There you go. Very good.
That's terrific.
Thanks, Brett. Sure. Some good information on how that will impact the property markets.
Okay.
Okay, very good. Joel, you had a presentation a while ago that was talking about infrastructure spending as well.
Yeah, that's right. So when I went to that fund manager presentation that I spoke about maybe two or three weeks ago, he was very bullish on the cyclical nature of or the cyclical industries in the Australian economy or on the Australian stock market that might benefit from this splurge in government spending. So obviously, you know, more projects, more infrastructure projects, more jobs, that leads to more money in people's pockets for potentially spending, consumption. Obviously, interest rates coming down as well has made it more affordable for and potentially easier for developers as well to start moving back into the market and getting some projects passed. So, you know, all of these things tend to be lining up for perhaps a bit of a cyclical turn in the Australian economy. And the Australian stock market's actually reflecting that, breaking out to more than decade highs. We haven't seen these levels on the ASX 200 for, you know, the best part of 11 years almost. And we're getting close now on the all-time high in the Australian stock market. So there's opportunities out there, high-quality businesses trading at cheap multiples, being left behind a little bit with this recent rally in growth stocks and tech and high-tech. But potentially there's some opportunity in some value stocks and cyclicals.
Yeah, very interesting. All right. It's all about infrastructure spending. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back after these messages.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Joel, I'll throw it back to you again. you want to talk about some crazy things happening in the stock markets. Well, what's crazy?
Well, we are 10 years into this current recovery phase from the 2009 depressive lows of the global financial crisis. And stocks are now breaking out to all-time highs, or close to breaking out to all-time highs, pretty much in Australia and the US, and there's certainly been some recovery in markets around Europe. Now, there's been an interesting study done by Stansbury Research analyst, Dr. Steve Sugarud, who had a look at some interesting movements that took place during the month of May for the US stock market. And what we had was a 6.6% decline in the S&P 500 during the month of May, which was actually the third worst decline in the US stock market in the month of May since 1950.
Sounds significant.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were some concerns by a number of people, the US economy slowing down, you know, we're late into this cycle and we're struggling to get out to all-time highs, and we've got back up to the previous highs in October of last year, and perhaps the market might be rolling over. Well, history suggests that that assumption is actually very wrong. In fact, there's been 8 instances in the past since 1950 where the US stock market has had a 5% or greater decline during the month of May. And subsequent to that, the 12 months following that worst May decline, and you might have heard the old saying, sell in May, go away, don't come back to Labor Day, which is Labor Day in the US. Because the period between May through to the end of October is actually... historically, you don't generate any return during that period of time.
They're almost summer holidays.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And most of the return in the Northern Hemisphere, and particularly in the US stock market, tends to happen between November and April. But interestingly enough, when May is actually a really bad month, it leads to significantly impressive results 12 months later. So the market has soared by more than 20% 12 months later in half of the 8 instances where the S&P 500 has declined by more than 5%. Mm-hmm. We had a 6.6% decline. And on average, the US stock market is up 18% across all 8 of those instances. And there's not been one 12-month period after a 5% or greater decline where the S&P 500 has posted a negative return 12 months later.
Wow. Right. So if history's a guide, there's no chance we're going backwards over the next 12 months.
Well, if history's a guide, yes. So,
but sometimes you're walking through a casino and you see the roulette wheel and it's got the last 20 results. Yep. And you see it's been red. Yep. Well, is it a pattern? Is it something that you can rely on?
Yeah. So look, it's interesting to note that this is all happening within the context of what we've seen as a sort of an 18-month sideways movement in the US stock market. And this type of sideways movement, even though there's been some big gyrations up and down in between, is consistent with what we would call a basing pattern, a consolidation pattern, a correction in time, although there's also been a fairly significant correction in price in between there as well. And these types of sideways corrective patterns don't usually last for much more than about 18 months to 2 years. And they often present very strong buying opportunities at the conclusion of this basing pattern. Mm-hmm. So... you know, and it just goes to show that when with some of the froth that we're seeing in the market at the moment with the IPOs, there's certainly a lot of exuberance still in the market. Even though we've had this this corrective pattern, we've had a lot of volatility in the last 18 months, investors still seem to be feeling pretty comfortable and confident to pay ridiculous prices for some of these investments. And in particular, the IPO market is absolutely booming at this point in time in the US.
Would you say it's crazy?
I would say it's damn right ridiculous in some of these names. So about 6 months ago, I think we spoke about a company called Tilray, which is a cannabis growing company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and the ridiculous price that it got to, I think it ended up doing something like about 1,000 or 1,500% in the first 3 months of it listing on the stock market, and it hadn't actually generated a cent of revenue at that stage.
Wow.
So Tilray, when we highlighted that, Tilray's now down around about 90% since its all-time peak.
Right.
About 6 months ago.
It's fallen 90%.
It's fallen about 90%. Even today, it trades on a trailing price to sales. Now, I just want you to think about this for a moment. This is price to sales, not price to earnings.
Yeah.
This is...
Right,
this is
not profit measurement at all.
No, not
just turnover.
Profit measurement at all of 84 times.
84 times its revenue.
So you would need that company. You're paying 84 years worth of sales, not profits. Remember, profits are often, you know, a fraction of what the sales are in any good business. Somewhere between 1/10 and maybe, you know, 1/5 of a business's sales. And you're paying 84 years worth of sales.
Jeez.
For that company. Now, no wonder the company is now down, you know, 90% from those highs.
Yeah, which is, for those not maths at instant recall, that's 1/10 of its former price.
Correct. That's right. Now, we've had some other really nosebleed IPOs come out onto the market as well. So just last week, we had a technology company by the name of Slack Technologies.
Yep.
They do a lot of workplace collaboration, project collaboration. It essentially gives you a big sort of chat room for projects, and so you can see exactly what's been communicated and a string of those communications for those participants on those projects. Now, I'm sure Slack is a pretty good idea, but there's plenty of other businesses that have the same type of offering and that they don't base their whole business around that one piece of really non-defensible technology. I can think of Microsoft Teams. I can think of Google. Yep. What's the Google one?
Hangouts.
Yep. Google Hangouts. and many, many others. Now, Slack currently today is trading on a price-to-sales ratio of 40 times and a forecasted price-to-sales ratio of 30 times. It's making significant losses. It's losing around a bit. Last year, it lost around about $150 million. It's expected to lose about $170 million next year. And it trades at 30 years worth of sales forecast. It's trading on a forecasted sales ratio for next year of 30 years.
So where's the return going to come from?
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out as well. So I actually see these as great candidates for short sale potential. So wait for the exuberance to come out of this stock. Wait for the lockup periods that are the end when insiders can actually start selling their stock. So for those listeners who don't actually understand what tends to happen here is you get a lot of venture capital investors that are investing in these new startups, these new technology businesses. The whole idea is to bring these startups to a listed IPO and give the insiders some form of liquidity to, at one stage down the track, get out of the stock and cash in and realize the gains that they've made in their investment in this business. They usually come with about a 6 to 12 month lag period. Sometimes it's as short as 3 months, and that's when all of the insiders can actually start selling their shares onto the market. So we often see this huge run up when these IPOs come on. These valuations make absolutely no sense, and then eventually, once all of the insiders can start selling, you tend to see a huge amount of selling pressure that comes in, and the stock just craters, which is what we saw with Tilray. And I think we're going to see with a number of these other businesses that have come onto the market. Slack Technologies is one I think could be a great candidate. There's no economic moat there. Yes, there's a subscription-based model, but I can see so much competition for this type of service that is being offered that I can't see it creating a network effect of any substance, because there's others out there that would probably have a better chance of creating a network effect.
And so someone like Google is going to just tweak their technology and offer it for free.
Well, they could, absolutely, yeah.
Or are they trying to? Are they getting valued on the basis of maybe not the revenue, that there's been other versions of similar software that may have been bought out at some point, and they think that they'll get the return by a share buyback or something?
I have no idea. I can't make any sense of these valuations. I mean, we can even look at Uber, which is maybe not as bad as some of these others, but even Uber's trading on huge multiple. I mean, Uber's may never ever make a profit the way that Uber's is looking.
That just dumbfounds me that people are investing so much money on something that's not generating any return at the moment. Yeah. It's bizarre.
We've got Zoom as well, which came out recently. Zoom is trading on about 82 times trailing sales.
Trailing sales, right?
Like, this is crazy.
Isn't it?
And so Zoom Communications, now I can think once again of Skype. I can think of, you know, Google Hangouts. I can think of
plenty of other conference calling stuff.
Go meet, go to meeting. I mean, all of these different video conferencing platforms.
I'm even thinking FaceTime.
FaceTime. All of these. Yet, you know, for whatever it is, for whatever reason, you know, everyone seems to think that Zoom is going to dominate the marketplace. Now, we have Zoom here. Mm. We use it. It's a good piece of software.
Yeah.
But so is Skype. So is GoToMeeting.
Yep. Any one of them will do the job.
Any one of them will do the job. Microsoft Teams or Microsoft 365 Teams does the same video conferencing as well. So, look, good piece of software. I just don't know. I would want to pay 84 years worth of sales for the business. Mm. But my favorite whipping boy at the moment, I think, is Beyond Meat. Now, has anyone heard of Beyond Meat?
Yeah, they make the vegetarian foods.
Well, what they do is it's plant-based meat products.
Yes, that's
okay.
So it's for those vegans out there that like a hamburger but don't want to actually buy the ham.
Yeah.
And it's made from, I believe it's like pea protein, and a whole range of other sort of plant-based compounds that they put together to create meat substitutes.
Right.
Once again, I mean, beyond meat, it makes something that's highly replicable. There's no real defensive moat around this. In fact, Tyson Foods, which was a major shareholder in Beyond Meat, and was a major supporter of Beyond Meat when it came to market, actually sold its shareholding in Beyond Meat because it's now going to compete with Beyond Meat to release its own food product.
Wow.
Now, if you are... Now, Nestle has also come out and announced that they're going to develop their own plant-based meat substitute products. You've had Conagra Foods. They're developing their own plant-based meat products. And there's about another one or two others that have just come out in the last week announcing their own lines of plant-based meat products. Now, Beyond Meat is, once again, trading at like 80 times sales. Jeez. 80 years worth of sales.
But those sales are going to be encroached on.
Now, if I'm an investor and I'm wanting to put money with one of these companies that is most likely going to have the distribution network to be able to put the product onto shelves in supermarkets and get it out there as quickly as possible and have the financial resources to do it, I'm going to back these well-established businesses like Conagra Foods, Tyson Foods, Nestle, that dominate the world and have their distribution networks that can get their product to market.
It is very hard to disrupt anything in the food and drink industry.
Yeah, so... You look, Beyond Meat, all of these businesses, their share prices are going through the roof at the moment, but I am starting to see a little bit of signs of selling, and a number of them have lockup periods that are about to come around the corner in the next 3 to 6 months' time. So I would be, rather than piling into these and being big believers in these types of investments, I'd actually be looking at them for potential short sales, because I think that there's anywhere between sort of 50 to 75% downside in some of these businesses. Some of these stocks, and some of them won't even be around in about 5 to 10 years' time.
And with all of those ones starting to play in the same market, maybe look at investing in the farms that are going to supply them. Anyway.
Yeah. So it just signs that, you know, okay, look, we're long in the tooth. We seem to have some constructive setups for the next, 12 months to 24 months ahead for the stock market. But we are getting... a little bit frothy here as well.
There's a big question that's coming to my mind out of all of this, Joel, is how do you value a company with all of this stuff?
Well, personally, I like profits.
Yeah.
Buying a company on a multiple of profits and free cash flow that the company can distribute back to shareholders and reward them with dividends, or that they can take that that profit and reinvest back into future growth and expansion. But companies trading at ridiculous priced sales multiples, burning through cash, losses as far as the eye can see. I just can't make sense of some of these things.
The thing that I struggle with all of this is in the property market, it's pretty easy to come to a value or, you know, within a couple of percent of what's a fair value based on comparable sales, what's on the market, that sort of thing. With the shares, though, if you look at it and you say, okay, if a company wasn't listed on the stock exchange and it was profitable and it wanted to sell, there's probably a multiple or sort of a formula that potential buyers would use.
Yeah.
Once you go onto the stock market, even though there's no profit, you know, is there any rationale to the multiple number, or is it? How does that work?
I can't make any rationale out of these current numbers, but eventually you're a shareholder for the benefit of sharing in the profits that business generates over time. Now, some of these companies don't look like they're ever going to turn a profit.
Brett, you can do an entire university unit on valuations. Mm. And in fact, you can do more than one. I mean, a professional valuer has oodles of knowledge and experience that goes with it. Mm. But at the end of the day, you need to find a buyer who's willing to pay the price.
Mm. Yeah.
And if buyers are rational, well, then you could come up with a valuation price. But if there's a buyer who's irrational, or in a share market, if you have a segment of buyers that are irrational, well, then you can get these extreme valuations.
So this raises an alarm bell for me in thinking of how all this comes about. Because more than likely, for these companies to list and go through their IPO, they're getting away from their institutional or seed investors and going to the broader public.
That's right. So these IPOs are being sold to retail investors.
Yeah, and they're the ones that sound like they're paying the inflated.
The smart money is already into these businesses back, mm-hmm. you know, 5-10 years ago.
Yeah.
Before the, you know, when these were just ideas.
Mm.
And this is where the venture capital money is now looking to, you know, cash out. And they're doing a fantastic job. I mean, I tell you what, I'd love to be, an investor in the venture capital funds.
Mm. Yeah.
But not so much in the businesses that they're bringing to market at the moment.
Because when the smart money's getting out, they're the ones that need to market it to the retail investors.
Right. Mm.
So they love building all the hype around the Beyond Meat products and the potential for medicinal marijuana.
Yeah.
And they want to talk up the share price so they can sell it at a higher price.
Mm. And I think we need to make a clear distinction here. Just because I'm negative on the share price doesn't mean that these businesses aren't selling something that I wouldn't buy or wouldn't want to use. Mm. I mean, we use Zoom here. We use software that's similar to Slack. The products and the services that these companies are delivering and are offering, and I'm a big user of Uber, and they're very useful with what they're doing. It's just that the valuations for the businesses make no sense.
Well, like most things, there's a price at which it makes sense to buy, and then there's a price that it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Yep.
Doesn't sound like these ones are making sense.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Because there's so much that goes into a successful business, and if Uber, as an example, I have to think, are selling their service at a substantial discount from what they should be in order to gain market share. Mm-hmm. And of course, everyone's going to love a service that's underpriced.
Mm. Absolutely.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, you get a great service and you pay not a lot for it. Mm. But in the meantime, the company's making massive losses. How long is it going to continue for?
And that's the big question.
That's right.
Well, and on Uber alone, I've noticed recently in Australia, we've had two or three other competing services come about. And I've noticed that the drivers will just alternate between where the demand comes from. They'll have multiple apps running and just pick and choose which service is being called for.
Yeah, so they're not loyal to Uber's platform.
Not at all.
No, that's right. Mm. That's right. Although my suspicion with the ride-sharing apps is that they're all a play on future technology changes where they don't need the drivers at all. And I think their plan is to become profitable with the introduction of driverless cars.
Well, how long do you wait for that?
Yeah, I know. I mean, will these businesses still be around by the time that technology is actually, broadly accepted?
Yep.
Because if you're making losses, you've got to keep funding those to survive. That's
exactly.
Challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I can't see driverless cars becoming broadly accepted for at least a decade and probably even beyond that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Very interesting. Mm. Thanks, Joel.
No
Very
promise.
Interesting to hear your story about crazy valuations. We'll be back after one more break.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And welcome back, listeners. I want to talk about clocking hours versus clocking.
Okay.
I like this.
And it's around productivity and what you actually achieve with your time. So, what do employers and businesses actually want?
Outcomes.
Definitely.
Outcomes and results.
Results, yep.
So, does the company measure those results well?
There's probably varied cases.
How do you measure them?
Yeah.
How do you measure them?
That's a really good question.
You've got to know what results you're looking for first, I guess.
Yep. Yeah. So, in this room, we've all probably had times that we've worked for good businesses and times that we've worked for not so good businesses. Mm-hmm. We've had good bosses and shit bosses.
Yep.
Everyone's had one.
Yeah.
You know who they are. You still have nightmares about them, I'm sure. So, there is what the business would actually benefit from, but then there are the people in the business that might be good managers, but might not be good managers. And then there's yourself, and there's your own life that you need to manage. And what I think is important for your life is for outcomes, not hours.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, when you come to work and other people are judging your performance, are they looking at the right things? Your hours present is a very easy thing to look at and to make a judgment call on. And that might not be the right thing. Because if there's a coworker of yours that you can think of that is always out the door right on 5 o'clock, or they arrive late, or if they work less hours, you've got a certain perception of them.
Mm.
And then with other coworkers who stay back late or arrive early every day, they do the longer hours, there's a certain perception of them. And that can be really frustrating for people who have time constraints. But more importantly, it can be even more frustrating for those good workers who actually achieve great results regardless of the amount of time that they spend in the office.
Yep.
So, I think everyone's agreeing with me that if you can achieve great results at your work or in your business, well, then it doesn't actually matter the number of hours that you work.
I think there's certain roles that do just demand time at the desk, so to speak, like a reception, a shop server. You know, there's certain things that you're open, someone just has to be there, but that's probably not relevant to the type of conversation we're having here.
You're right, Brett. There's definitely jobs that have what I would call spare capacity, where the person is underutilized, where they're just standing around or sitting around and not doing much. And I think those types of jobs are getting fewer and fewer between.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those jobs are, they tend to be low skill jobs as well.
Yep.
Because if they were higher skill, well, then that person would be utilized more to use those skills instead of having those dead hours. So the key for me is productivity. Mm-hmm. So how can you be productive at your workplace? How can you get more outcomes out of the hours that you're doing? Mm-hmm. And I come to a conclusion that in order to be productive at work, you need to be healthy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a given.
And there's this big link, and more research and studies coming out about people who are healthy being more productive.
Mm-hmm.
And statistic I heard is that in Australia, 97% of Australia's most successful companies have a health and well-being program in their workplace.
Right, okay.
So health and well-being is definitely in the mainstream about being important for efficiency and productivity. So if you want to be productive, what should you focus on? Well, focus on your concentration span. And how do you improve your concentration? Well, there's a whole range of factors that go into concentration. Mm-hmm. There's exercise, eating the right foods, trying to stay away from sugary treats during the workday, but you're only going to stay away from sugary treats if you've got the good food there and you've got the right movement and exercise in your body to keep your body on a stable energy level through the day. There's mindset and happiness levels and managing your stress levels and things like that. All that go into being more productive in the workplace.
I was just listening to a podcast the other day where they had an interviewee talking about the benefit of breaks. Now, we're not talking about, you know, going out and having a half-hour walk every, you know, every hour or so, but the benefit of a micro break.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stepping away from the computer, letting your eyes, even just sitting at the computer and looking at something else away from the computer screen for a minute can give you re-energize you and revitalize you. Or, you know, stepping away, not keeping a phone with you, having a proper break where you disconnect for, you know, a minute or two, go and make yourself a tea or step out and get some fresh air and then come back into the office, you know, every sort of hour, every hour and a half or so, can have a huge boost to somebody's focus and energy levels.
Absolutely, absolutely. If you look at sports people on football fields, well, they take breaks, don't they?
Yep, the rotations.
They have their rotations and they rest their muscles. Now, for us in the workplace, in an office environment, our brain is our muscle. And you got to rest that muscle from time to time. Mm. You got to put it on the interchange bench. Mm. And you're exactly right, Joel. Don't spend your break surfing on your phone or looking at just another screen. You want to be able to switch off.
Don't go to the bench and tackle each other. Keep playing. You're there for the break.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. Exactly. So I think all these things go into being productive and getting better outcomes at work. Mm. Once you're getting the better outcomes, you actually realize the reward for that. Mm. But there's a few things to do if you're going to change the people and the business and environment around you to allow you to do that. So, step one, manage yourself. First, you actually have to start getting the better outcomes. Step two, manage your manager. Because if your manager is watching your hours and not your productivity, then you need to change that. So if you're going to have an approach, then it needs to include your manager and communication with that person to say, look, I'm going to make sure that I achieve these results. Can you please make sure that these are the results that you need and that we are being measured against these results?
When I went to Japan about 4 years ago, we bumped into a group of young professionals at a bar, and we were having a nice chat with them, and they were talking about this whole idea behind FaceTime, having to be present at the office and not leaving until the manager left. And, you know, and a lot of the time it was just very unnecessary, but that's what culturally they needed to do in order to be shown that they were putting in the time and the effort and the dedication to their job. But Louis, what you're saying is that you need to actually change that dynamic. You need to change that whole scenario so that your manager is now assessing you based on what you're actually achieving and doing and producing.
Absolutely. You need to manage that manager. And then I would say that you need to manage the team and the co-workers around you as well, because they're going to be judging you as well. And as much as you're managing your manager, there's other people around you who are also trying to manage their manager as well. So if someone next to you continues to put in long hours and not achieve those results, well, you need to manage that person as well so that they don't start complaining about you and getting in other people's ears because of your number of hours. you need to help that people to manage themselves and be more productive and work against their productivity, not against their number of hours.
Mm. Yeah.
So that is my message for the day.
Actually, this reminds me, have you guys heard that story about the invoice for the tapping with a hammer? I don't know if you've heard.
No, I haven't. What's that story?
I'm surprised you haven't heard this one. And look, I'll probably get some of the detail wrong, but the concept I think I'll grasp is, so there was a factory that had a particular machine that had broken down, mm-hmm. and the engineers within the company couldn't figure out what to fix, so they called in an expert. And, you know, they'd spent a bit of time trying to figure this out, couldn't get there. They call in an expert, he asks a few questions, he walks around, grabs a hammer, taps a certain part of the machine three times, says switch it back on and everything works fine. And then he issues them an invoice for a significant amount of money. So, of course, the boss sees this invoice and goes, God, he was only here for, you know, less than an hour. How can he be charging so much? Show me a breakdown detail as to why this is so expensive. And so he gets the invoice and it says, tapping with a hammer, $5. Knowing where to tap, $5,000. So it was the ability to generate the outcome was why the price was there, not the time it took him to deliver the outcome.
Very much so. Very good. Well, let's move on with the show to our favourite segment.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious.
All right. Who has something unusual to talk about today?
Yeah, well, look, I was screening the internet looking for some funny things to talk about today, and I came across some of the worst mistakes brands have ever made, and I got to say, I was having a nice little chuckle about these before the podcast today.
All right.
So I've got a few of them here. We've got American Apparel accidentally tweets a national tragedy. So back in 2014, American Apparel used an image of Space Shuttle Challenger, the disaster, in a bid for a 4th of July promotion. They didn't realise that the actual explosion was the Challenger explosion, and they thought it was just a 4th of July fireworks.
My goodness.
Big fail. Major fail. Now, US Airways tweets porn. We always love a reference to porn. So the headline says it all. Okay, so maybe it was a little more complicated than that. But an angry customer reached out to US Airways with a complaint. And they tried to respond nice and quickly. But what actually happened was the employee actually retweeted a tweet that had actually been put on their website, which had a pornographic image on it. So when the complainant... sent their tweet in, it was accidentally retweeting a porno image to that.
Oh, my goodness.
I messed that up.
And then there's another brand. I actually don't know this brand, but DiGiorno. Does anyone know that brand?
No, I don't.
Not familiar.
Anyway, they misused a hashtag about domestic violence. So in 2014, the hashtag Why I Stayed became popular as a show of support and means of storytelling for victims of domestic abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, they missed the message, and an employee at DiGiorno replied to Why I Stayed, saying because there was pizza.
Oh my goodness!
Missed the point there.
Jeez.
Bang! Major fails. Major fails.
Far out. I've got one of a dad who does the best dad thing that I've almost ever heard of.
Ooh.
His teenage daughter explained to him what an Instagram influencer is. And do you guys know what an Instagram influencer is?
Yeah.
Basically someone who posts lifestyle photos of themselves and people
and a lot of followers.
Follow them because they have a certain lifestyle. And so what does this dad say? I can do that. So he starts an Instagram account. The account is called Just a Construction Guy. And he's just a regular guy with a pretty impressive goatee, I must say.
Yeah.
And he posts photos of himself doing construction things and also a piss take of the standard Instagram photos, wearing high-vis and a hard hat.
Yep.
And he's got over 300,000 followers on Instagram.
And he's probably getting sponsored by Hard Yakka
and
Brunstone. That's right, nice, exactly. So there's a dad who's shown it to his daughter.
Yep.
Nice.
One for the property industry. Anyone that's tried to edit their or renovate their property or even develops probably had some issues with council getting permits approved. Well, what if it took you 137 years to get your permit approved?
137 years.
And people, I would assume people out there listening will be more familiar with this than they realise, but it's Barcelona's Sagrada Familia.
Ah, the big cathedral.
Correct. Right. So it was sort of lost in the mix because it was, you know, started back in 1882, and the application for a permit was never actually issued until earlier just this year. Right. So 137 years later.
Is there a fine for building without a permit for 137 years?
So, anyone out there waiting for a permit from council, just keep holding.
I wonder if they had to pull it down as a result.
And just before we go, one other one that I thought, oh, geez, imagine this in an Australian country. So this was in Poland, but occasionally we hear stories of, you know, people taking the work car for the weekend and having a bit of fun, or taking it, you know, where they might not be able to usually. And occasionally you also hear of idiots that do a bit of drink driving. Mm-hmm. Well, what if there was a combination of someone that had the work car and was driving drunk, but the work car was a T-55 tank? So, yes, there was a man who had been authorized to drive the tank, was out one night in a T-55 driving through the streets of Pajeksno in Poland.
Oh, my goodness.
There you go. Nice.
Jeez.
Nice.
Just what you don't want. Swerving on the streets in front of you.
No, thanks.
Thanks, guys. It's been a pleasure doing another episode with you.
Thanks, Louis.
Thanks listeners, Louis, for tuning in. We'll catch you again soon.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.